EoE is a tricky condition to treat. The symptoms mimic other more common GI conditions, so it may go underrecognized. Plus, the steps to achieving remission can be complicated and confusing for patients. That's where a skilled and savvy dietitian can help. In this episode, Sarah Glanz gives you a crash course on EoE. That way, you'll be ready the next time this condition walks through your door. You're listening to Dietitians Only, a podcast from Dietitians on Demand, created by dietitians for dietitians. Let's get into it.
Welcome back to Dietitians Only. This is Sarah Glanz, and I have Sarah Heitzman joining me today. You may remember her from previous episodes. Hey, Sarah. In this episode, we're going to talk about a complex nutritional issue called eosinophilic esophagitis, which we're going to be calling EoE from now on. EoE is receiving more attention as the years go on, as clinicians are understanding it better. And today we're going to talk about what the condition is and what role a dietitian has in treating patients with EoE. So let's start with a review of some terminology that we're going to be using in this podcast episode. Just as a reminder, eosinophils are a type of white blood cell, and they're typically present at a site of inflammation. And commonly, they can indicate an allergic reaction. And we're going to talk throughout this episode about how EoE has some ties to food allergens. The second term is esophageal eosinophilia, which sounds a lot like EoE, but simply put, this means that we have eosinophils, or these white blood cells, in the esophagus. It's not necessarily a problem at this point, like it's not diagnosable as EoE, but basically what it means is that there are white blood cells there in the esophagus where they shouldn't be. And there could be many reasons why for this, which we're going to discuss a little bit later.
Awesome. Let's talk about what EoE is.
Okay, yeah. So EoE is a chronic allergic inflammatory condition. It does have a connection with food allergens, but it's not the same as food allergies. So we want to make that distinction. As the name suggests, it affects the esophagus and is caused by dysfunction in the esophageal tissue barrier. So if you think about the lining of your esophagus, kind of like the layers of your skin, there's different layers of it. And so when there's a breakdown in the barrier of the esophageal tissue, then you can have these food allergens that are exposed to the submucosal levels. So the condition and the inflammation associated with the condition is triggered by exposure to food antigens. So again, like I said, we have a breakdown in the barrier. Food allergens or antigens are allowed to enter through the barrier, and then they create inflammation in the submucosal level. EoE is kind of like, sometimes it's called an inside-out disorder or an inside-out condition, because the inflammatory damage can work from, it can work its way down, if that makes sense. So EoE eventually results in some destructive tissue remodeling. And so what we see that manifesting as clinically is tissue scarring, and sometimes esophageal strictures, which you've probably encountered patients who have esophageal strictures, and you know that they can have difficulty swallowing and dysphagia and things like that.
Yeah. Speaking of which, can you talk a little bit about who's affected by EoE? Is it just a pediatric condition?
It's not just a pediatric condition. So that's actually kind of a misconception about EoE. It is commonly diagnosed in pediatric populations, so I think that's how it gets that reputation, but it can affect all ages, and it has a 1 in 10,000 prevalence, so it's not that common. But like I said, we are recognizing it more and more as we are understanding the condition better. And interestingly, it impacts males primarily at a rate of about 3 to 1. So most commonly, you would see EoE in a male patient.
Interesting. What are some of the symptoms of EoE that would prompt a patient to get that checked out?
That's a great question. And it can be really tricky because the symptoms can vary depending on the age of the patient. So like I said, most commonly this is diagnosed in children and pediatrics. And so when you're working with infants and children, They may present with some feeding difficulties, like refusal to eat, not eating well, not breastfeeding or taking the bottle well. They may have reflux, which, you know, is not common in children. Vomiting and weight loss. So obviously those are all concerning symptoms and are very atypical in infants and children. So that's why, that might be why it's more commonly diagnosed in children and pediatrics, because we have more of these symptoms that are very abnormal and that do typically prompt some sort of medical intervention.
Sure.
And then when you're dealing with teens and adults, the symptoms can be much more nondescriptive and a little bit confusing. So a lot of times it'll present as solid food dysphagia. So difficulty swallowing specific foods, it doesn't occur with all foods and it may not occur every time the patient eats. But if you think back to some of the damage that's happening in the esophagus, it's causing strictures and inflammation. So it might be causing like some swelling and edema in the esophagus. And so, of course, that's just going to make it harder to swallow, which that can then lead to food impaction. And interestingly, when a patient presents with food impaction in the esophagus, which just means that food has physically gotten stuck in the esophagus and it can't go down, typically when that happens, that does indicate that there's some sort of pathophysiology in the esophagus that is really not normal for that to happen, even with patients with dysphagia. And then also it can present as chest pain, which again is, you know, commonly a symptom that you would seek medical attention for, but, you know, EOE is not going to be high on the list of conditions that they would evaluate for someone who's going to present with chest pain.
Yeah.
And then for everyone of all ages, we commonly see GERD-like symptoms. So like the esophageal reflux, heartburn, belching, that sort of thing. And then esophageal dysphagia.
And how is that, how is EOE diagnosed?
So EOE is kind of like a condition or a diagnosis of exclusion, which means that we don't have a super great way to diagnose it, but we can diagnose it by ruling out other similar conditions. And so if you're having some of these symptoms that we just discussed, the first step would be to seek out, you know, your primary care provider or get a referral to a GI physician. Typically, they're going to complete an EGD, which is, it stands for esophagogastroduodenoscopy, just an upper scope. So they're going to take a look in your esophagus, stomach, and duodenum just to see if there are any areas of inflammation or anything that looks concerning. They're going to take biopsies anywhere that they do find inflammation. And then when the pathologist looks at the biopsies and the tissue under the microscope, they're going to be looking for those eosinophils, so those specific types of white blood cells that we mentioned. And we can diagnose or we can classify it as esophageal eosinophilia. So remember, that's not actual EOE. That just means that we have eosinophils where they don't belong. So we can classify it as esophageal eosinophilia if there are 15 or more of these eosinophils in the sample size on your microscope slide. Try saying that three times fast. So the next step, like I said, is to rule out other causes of esophageal eosinophilia. So basically, we just want to make sure that there's not any other reason for these eosinophils to be there. And that's kind of how we arrive at the diagnosis of EOE.
Yeah. What are some of the other causes of esophageal eosinophilia?
So the most common ones are going to be Crohn's disease, which I know we commonly think of as affecting like the colon and the small intestine, but Crohn's disease can really impact any area of the GI tract from top to bottom. So you can have active Crohn's disease in the esophagus, so that could potentially be a cause. Achalasia. Achalasia is when you have dysfunction of the peristaltic contractions in the esophagus. So that can result in dysphagia, food impaction. Commonly, we see tightening of that lower esophageal sphincter, which is the valve between the esophagus and the stomach. And so that's another condition. Also, if they have an active infection or they're healing from an active infection. And then sometimes even medication reactions can cause white blood cells to appear in the esophagus. And so, you know, some of these are more benign than others, but the point is we have to rule out these other causes, because as we're going to discuss, the treatment and the process of kind of managing EoE is very intense. And so we want to make sure that we actually do have EoE before we go down that road.
Awesome. As you said, once somebody is diagnosed with EoE, what is the recommended nutrition therapy?
So once you actually get a diagnosis, the next step is to determine which foods are triggering EoE, because really the goal is to eliminate the trigger foods, but first we have to actually identify the trigger foods. So as I mentioned, EoE is triggered by food allergens that are able to penetrate the esophageal barrier. And so this relates to food allergens. It's caused by exposure to food allergens, but that's not food allergies per se, like your typical traditional food allergies. Traditional food allergies are mediated by IgE, and EoE is believed to be mediated by IgG4. So it's just a different process, which we don't need to get into the specifics, but it's just a different process and it's a different reaction that's occurring. So the translation is that traditional food allergy tests like a skin prick test or a blood test, that's not necessarily going to help you determine what foods the trigger foods are. So you actually have to go through this process of doing a stepwise strategic elimination diet. And this is the process, and this is the part that can get really tricky, especially if patients are trying to do this on their own without any supervision or help. So generally, there's two options to do the elimination diet. They're both very similar. One is a little bit slower. One is a little bit more accelerated. So that's really the main difference between them. But they both relate to eliminating the big eight food allergens. So soy, eggs, wheat, cow's milk, tree nuts, peanuts, fish, and shellfish. And so those are kind of the biggest and most popular culprits, I guess you could say, when it comes to EoE. So the goal is to eliminate those, and then you keep testing and you keep tracking to see if inflammation returns. The first version of the elimination diet is called the six food elimination diet, and it does incorporate all of the big eight food allergens. So you're probably like, why is it called the six food elimination diet? But it's because they've grouped fish and shellfish together into one group and then peanuts and tree nuts into one group. So there's actually just six. So the first step is to eliminate all of the big eight food allergens for 6 weeks. And this has to be a strict elimination. If you accidentally eat something that you're not supposed to, you have to start over. And so it can it can be really hard. And so that's why, you know, you definitely want to make sure that you have a registered dietitian that's helping with this process so that you understand where and, you know, where you might have exposure of these food allergens. Yeah. So once you do that and you've done that for 6 weeks.
Absolutely. Yeah.
The second step is you reintroduce one food group at a time. So, you know, pick whichever one you want, you reintroduce it. And then the patient has to get a repeat EGD or upper scope after each reintroduction to see if the inflammation has returned. So if the inflammation has returned, then you know that that food group is a trigger. If it has not returned, then you know that that food is safe. And then you just keep repeating those steps until you've gone through all of the big eight food allergens. So it can take quite a while to go through this process, like 6 months, you know, to get through this process. So
yeah,
it can be very lengthy and time intensive.
Sure.
The second version of this is a lot faster and it can be just as effective. So it's potentially a better option for some people. This is called the step up elimination, or some people call it the 2-4-6 diet. And so it's a very similar concept. The only difference is instead of eliminating one food group at a time, you are grouping two food groups together. So you're kind of cutting it in half, essentially. So step one is to eliminate wheat and dairy. And there's a reason why wheat and dairy are the first ones on the list to be eliminated. And that's because they are the most common EoE triggers. there was a small study done looking at trigger foods for patients with EoE, and they found that about 75% of patients achieve remission after eliminating wheat and dairy. So if you're going to start with anything, I'd say start with those. So once you eliminate those for 6 weeks, you get an EGD. If inflammation is still present, you know that there's at least some other trigger out there. So the next step is to eliminate egg, soy, and legumes for 6 weeks. And then, you know, do another EGD. If inflammation is still present, then you need to go forward with eliminating nuts and tree nuts and fish and shellfish. So like I said, this is more accelerated. It's not as targeted, but at least it you can, you know, make some progress a little bit faster. So the dietitian's role is really to help oversee these complicated diets because, like I said, it's, you know, especially if the patient is eating some processed or convenience foods, they can have contamination with food allergens and they're not going to get a reliable evaluation. Also, educating on once they have identified their trigger foods, educating on, you know, what versions of these foods are safe versus might contain contaminants or other triggers. And then also, depending on how many trigger foods they do have to end up eliminating, making sure that they're not developing any nutrient deficiencies because they're, you know, eliminating several different foods and food groups.
Yeah. Are there any other medications or treatments for EoE?
There are. And so I want to preface this by saying that, you know, going through this really lengthy process of identifying trigger foods and eliminating them, that's really the ultimate goal. And that's really the only thing that's going to put a patient into remission is if they eliminate the trigger foods. But for some people, it's not feasible to go through that process. You know, if you're dealing with like a really young child, it may be difficult. Or maybe you want to wait to pursue something like that. Again, like if you have a child, you know, maybe you want to wait to start it after school gets out, you know, whatever. But in the case that they can't pursue the elimination diets, sometimes the GI physician might prescribe steroids just to help control the inflammation. Antihistamines or proton pump inhibitors can also be used. If the patient's having frequent issues with esophageal strictures, they may require dilation, which is where they just put a scope down in a tool and kind of like blow out the esophagus, so, you know, and open it up again. So that can be necessary at some point. These treatments are not going to achieve remission. Like I said, it's more about controlling symptoms. And so it's, you know, it's not a one size fits all solution for everyone, but it's a decision to be made with the patient and their physician.
Awesome. Thanks, Sarah. That's really interesting. I hope everyone that joined in today learned something new, at least one thing. And thanks so much for having me on this episode.
Awesome. I'm glad you could be here. And we hope to see you again next time.
As a listener of Dietitians Only, your opinion matters. What do you like about the podcast? Who do you want us to interview next? We invite you to visit our show notes to complete a quick survey. It only takes a few minutes, and your feedback will help us create future episodes you'll love. Dietitians On Demand employs hundreds of dietitians nationwide and elevates the profession with simple yet effective practice resources, like this podcast. Don't forget to stay connected with us on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram. The information in this podcast is not intended or implied to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. All content is for general information purposes only. You are encouraged to confirm any information obtained from or through this podcast with other sources and review all information regarding any medical condition or treatment. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay seeking medical treatment because of something you heard in this podcast.